Hey guys, don't forget the 2023 Street Cop Training Conference, Nashville, Tennessee, April 23rd through the 28th. You do not want to miss this. So far, guest speakers, Rob O'Neill, the Navy SEAL that was responsible for killing Osama bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, U.S. Marine, Medal of Honor recipient, jumping on an IED to protect his platoon. Fox News host Tommy Lahren returns for 2023. Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff Mark Lamb, Sheriff David Clark, and more to come. You don't want to miss this event. We additionally have 20 of the country's top law enforcement educators giving you the best experience of your life. You will leave this event knowing more about your job and how to be proficient at the things you do, hands down, any other event that you'll ever attend. I personally guarantee it. Don't miss out. There's a room code at streetcop.com for our room block and room code at the Gaylord at Opry is where the event's taking place. Don't miss out on a discounted rate. The rate is from Sunday to Thursday. Put that in and find yourselves at a half-price room. Split it with a friend, but make sure you get there. You don't want to miss this event. It is going to be that good. If you trust me and you trust Street Cop, trust that you will leave there feeling like you've had an experience of a lifetime.
You trying to be a street cop?
Nick Lavery, maybe you can give us the 3 to 5 minute version of who you are. I know a lot about you, but for the street cop audience, give us some insight as to who you are, where you grew up, and kind of how you ended up in the circumstances that you ended up in. Maybe the brief version will go back and backtrack
sure.
into it.
So originally from Boston, Mass, which would have come out here eventually. So it's probably no surprise to you, Dennis. But born and raised, looked at the military as an option my sophomore year of high school. Met with a recruiter, and he's like, graduate high school and then come down. We'll get you taken care of. The only thing that prevented that from happening was I started getting recruited to play football my junior year, and then I was really getting recruited my senior year. So I ended up going to college just to play ball, which I did. And then sophomore year of college for me was 9/11. An impactful moment, right? For a lot of us that were at least old enough to recognize the gravity of the situation. And at that point, I really struggled to stay in school because I knew we were going to be going to war. And I was really angry and I wanted to be part of that response. Listen to some family and some mentors. Ultimately decided to stay in, grind out the rest of my degree. And then I began looking at options to enter the military at that point. Ended up going with what is known as the 18X ray contract option, which is that of a special forces recruit, which means that the Army gives guys directly off the street the chance to bypass the conventional Army and go straight into the Army Special Forces pipeline to hopefully and eventually become a Green Beret. So that's what I did. I was successful at making it through, the course. Originally, I was a 18 Bravo, which they're the weapons sergeants on the teams. We specialize in weapons and tactics. Was in Afghanistan, I'd say within maybe 6 months after completing the course on my first deployment. Came back from that, did a bunch of training, went back to Afghanistan on a short little thing. Came back from that, reset, and then I went back to Afghanistan again the third time. Which is my second combat deployment in September of 2012. And it was on that deployment that I was wounded in action on three separate occasions. First time, I took some shrapnel to the back of my shoulder. Second time, about a month later, I took an AK-47 round to the side of my face. And then a few months after that, as a result of an insider attack, meaning a guy that we had been training and going on operations with turned on us, I took a bunch of machine gun rounds to my legs, mostly to my right leg, which ultimately resulted in an above-the-knee amputation. I spent a year at Walter Reed learning how to live life as a one-legged guy and learning how to use a prosthetic and all that stuff. Got back to my unit. The Army tried their damnedest to have me removed, have me medically retired. So I ended up in an administrative street fight with the Army, which I won. Began working as an instructor, teaching combatives, which is hand-to-hand combat and close quarters battle, as I began more advanced rehabilitation. And then I got to a point that I decided I was ready to give it a shot to get back onto the team, which really was the goal from the beginning. And after what ended up being about a 12-week assessment days of just a variety of different tests. I earned my spot back on the team. And then just, you know, 6 weeks later, I was back in Afghanistan again, my fourth time, my first time as a one-legged dude. I am considered the first and to date only special operator to return to combat as an above-the-knee amputee. And really since then, you know, I've deployed to combat again multiple times in multiple different continents. I did make the transition to warrant officer coming up on 4 years ago. It was kind of the natural progression in my career. Did that. And actually just as of about 9 weeks ago, my ODA time, my team time has actually just recently come to an end, which in itself is a difficult transition. You know, it's really the only job most of us really want to do. But you can't do it forever. You know, I had a great run. I've been doing this now just over 15 years. So I'm now working at the next echelon of leadership at the command or the company command level is where I work now as a company operations warrant officer. Yeah, man. I mean, I guess the bottom line is I'm just going to continue doing what I do for as long as I'm an asset to the guys to my left and right. And then just to round out the intro, man, last and most certainly not least, actually, it's very first, is extraordinarily proud husband and father to two young boys. Our oldest is 5 and our youngest is 18 months. And they are the absolute highlight of my life.
Mm-hmm. I know that. I have 4.
Good for you.
So I want to go back a little bit to 9/11. You know, I'm from New Jersey. I was a month away from joining Police Academy. That's when I was starting. I actually started 10/9/01 is my first day of Police Academy here in New Jersey. And I was 19 going to the Academy. I turned 20 in the Academy. And I remember working that morning. I was delivering pizza and actually watching the towers fall. And I think a lot of people have a hard time now as time has passed of trying to really understand what it felt like at that time, the vulnerability, the frustration, the anger. And, you know, I know that that was a big motivating factor as to why you joined the armed forces, but can you go back to those moments of 9/11 and how you were feeling?
Yeah, man. You know, my morning started off kind of unusual for me because I was actually going to class that day, which was kind of rare, but I'm on the way to class and, you know, the entire student body is moving back towards the dorms. And I stop some dude and I'm like, hey, what's going on? He's like, all the classes are canceled. And I'm like, oh, this is perfect because I really didn't want to go anyway. So I, you know, turn around, start making my way back to the dorm room and I turn on the television. And of course, everything is on every channel. And it took a minute for it to set in as to what I was actually viewing live. And, you know, I don't come from a military family, really. I had a, you know, my grandfather was at the tail end of World War II. I had an uncle that served in the Navy for a little bit, but I don't come from a strong military family background. That's not to say that at the time of 9/11, I wasn't patriotic because I was certainly proud of being American and proud of our culture and way of life. Things have certainly kind of gone amplified over the last, you know, 15 years, me being in service. But even at that time, in that moment, just witnessing my, you know, fellow Americans making the choice between burning alive or jumping out of a building, it just sent this rage through my body. And all I could think of was, how fucking dare you do this? Like, you have no idea who you just fucked with. We are going to hunt you down and annihilate you and anyone that has ever been associated with this. And I am going to be part of that. So a lot of rage, a lot of anger, more so than it was me, you know, having the Star Spangled Banner flowing through my brains or through my veins and wanting to, you know, serve my nation. That really didn't come for me until a little bit later. Initially, it was just completely pissed off and I'm going to be part of this fight to get back at you.
I know in other interviews you've had, your parents weren't super thrilled with the idea of you joining the military. And it's funny because as you talked about 9/11, we started, I remember my father coming to me and I think a lot of his friends' kids were joining the military with that age, right? 19, 20. And, you know, like I said, I was going to Police Academy and he sat me down and said, you know, can I talk to you for a few minutes? And I said, whatever you want, what do you got? He said, you know, a lot of my friends' kids are going to join the military. And he goes, and my father was in the Army. He was a sergeant in the Army during the Vietnam War. He never got deployed. He was a I think he joined the National Guard to avoid going to Vietnam. I think it was his intention. He knew he was going to get drafted, so he joined the Guard as fast as he could. And he served with the Guard for 4 years. But he said, you know, are you thinking about going? You thinking about going down there and joining the military? I said, Dad, I'm going to the police academy. I think there's a, for me at that time, I was livid. I was angry and a lot of thought put into it. But I think my, you know, what I was intending on doing was set in stone. And I really had to come to peace with that myself of, well, they still need cops here. Right. So like, I have to put some thought into what my mission is here. And I'm not certainly, believe me, I'm not comparing what I went through to what you went through. You are, but it just reminds me of that. I think we were all in the same mindset. And it's just very interesting that your parents were just as concerned as mine were, except your story was different. So can you tell us a little about what your parents said to you about when you told them you wanted to join the military?
Yeah, man. By the time I made this decision, I was 24 years old. I graduated college. I had a lot of life experience in me. I wasn't, you know, a 17-year-old kid who hadn't left his house ever. And I made my decision. And I'm not sure if I had signed a contract yet or not. I don't think I had quite yet, but I called my father first and I said, hey, dude, I'm joining the Army. I'm taking a special forces recruit contract. And if all goes well, I'll become a Green Beret. And my father and I are real close in age. He had me when he was, you know, 20. So he's my father, but he's also my best friend. And his response to me was, no, you're not. You know, period. end of sentence. He was just like telling me the answer was no, as if I was asking him his permission. And of course, that comes from a place of, you know, fear and concern about your only son going to combat, which he's now seeing across, you know, every news outlet there is. And my mother was also, you know, obviously concerned. She didn't quite have the same response as my father did, but, you know, obviously both of them were concerned about where I'd end up, because the likelihood of me avoiding combat, as if that was the goal, was extraordinarily low. So if I were successful at what I was trying to do, I would, you know, be in combat. And, you know, at the time, me at 24, I could kind of appreciate that from a, you know, father to son perspective. Now that I have, even though my boys are small, you know, I look back and I can even more understand where he's coming from, like that, just that protective instinct. So totally understood it then, understand it even more now. And of course, now you come full circle 15 or so years later. And, you know, my father is my biggest fan. He reads all the, you know, Green Beret books. And he's all into it. It's like he's got a Special Forces hat on everywhere he goes. So it didn't quite start that way, but, you know, that's where we are today.
I bet you that he's super proud of you, man. I bet you just is. What a son. I mean, you really are an example of what all of us want our children to grow up to be, and just a respectable, honorable, brave. How did they handle your injuries, your parents?
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, I kind of set them up for failure, because, you know, when you get wounded in combat, there's a notification process that happens like immediately. So, you know, I was wounded the first time, took some shrapnel. It really wasn't that big of a deal. I was out of the fight like a week, and then I was right back to conducting ops. Before I could even get to a phone to call them, someone else in the chain of command had notified them. Hey, Nick was wounded. He's okay. This is what I can tell you about the injury, and like, he'll call you tonight or he'll call you tomorrow, like whatever. So that had happened twice. Shrapnel, and then I take an AK-47 round to the face, which also sounds a lot worse than it was. I got really lucky. It just like grazed my cheek, sliced open my face, but it wasn't a big deal. So they get the second phone call, very similar, you know, and hearing it from them is funny, because the phone rings, they picks it up. He's like, hey, this is, you know, Major so-and-so. Nick's been wounded again. He was shot in the face, but before you freak out, like, he's fine. I've already seen him. I've talked to him. He's okay. He's really angry, but he's fine. He'll call you tonight. So then the third time happens, like a couple months after that, phone rings again. Hey, this is Major so-and-so, and Nick's been wounded. And now they've been kind of conditioned to getting these calls. Well, now things are wildly different. I mean, I'm in like critical condition and it doesn't look like I'm going to live. So they're like, hey, this time it's a little different. He's going to be at Walter Reed within the next like 3 to 4 days. We're going to book your flights and get you to Walter Reed, because if he makes it there, like, it's still going to be kind of touch and go. So then it was like, holy shit, you know, like I may actually lose my son for real. So after getting hit with that tidal wave, obviously I make it because I'm here talking to you. And then, you know, my father was, they were both there at the hospital when I got there. And then my father stayed with me at Walter Reed for the first like 6 weeks or 6 months that I was there. He was my, what they call non-medical assistant. So he was like my guy to help me do all the things I needed to do, you know, so he lived with me. And so he had a front row seat to, you know, the real early stages of my recovery and my rehabilitation. And then came the, you know, I'm going to go back, and that's kind of a separate conversation, but, you know, so I think from them initially, it just went the gamut of emotions to, holy shit, I'm gonna lose my son, to, no, he's alive. He's getting better. He's getting stronger. Things look good. And then comes the next news where I'm going to try to get myself back into the fight. And then they had to kind of deal with that.
Have they shared with you what they went through in those 3 or 4 days while they're waiting for your arrival, what they emotionally went through?
Yeah, we've talked about it a bunch, and they were petrified, but maintained faith. That they would tell you that they knew I was strong, you know, physically and mentally. And if anyone could make it through that, it would be me. So I think they maintained a positive mentality the best that they could. And then once they saw me, like physically saw me, they pulled me off the ambulance when I first arrived at Walter Reed, and they're both there. They would tell you that it was in that moment that even though I was still in technically in critical condition, they were like, okay, he's going to be okay. I know he's going to be okay.
Do you remember being transported to Walter Reed? Were you conscious at that time?
I have small flashes of the memory. You know, I was whacked out on like all of the pain meds. So the one thing I do remember is that there's the flight that they put you on to bring you from places like Afghanistan to Germany, and then from Germany to Walter Reed. They basically gut, you know, a C-17, a military jet, and they turn it into a hospital. It's like, wow. It's like an airborne hospital. It's wild. And I was the only one on this flight. And I can remember, I can remember parts of that flight, because there was a whole team around me that were monitoring me the entire time around the clock to keep me stable. So I have some small flashes of that. And then, but really my first solid memory is at Walter Reed in the intensive care unit, when the chief orthopedic surgeon comes in and he tells me, "Hey dude, here's the deal. Right now, most of your leg is gone. We've amputated this spot at this point, just above your knee, but you're riddled with infection. And any one of these infections could kill you. So my staff wants to take you into the operating room right now. And they want to amputate your leg at the hip and just eliminate this threat and just get you moving on with life. But I think I could save more your leg. It's just going to be a street fight. And I need you in the fight with me." And I looked up at him, and I just met this guy, and he's telling me that there's like bacteria in my body that could kill me, but he wants to save more of my leg. And I was just like, "Hey doc, roger that, you know, let's do that." I don't think I quite processed what he was telling me medically. I think I just heard, "Hey man, I'm going to go get into a street fight. Do you want to come with me?" And I'm like, "Yes, I do. Let's go do that option." So this guy, he's still a real close friend of mine. He's now a full-bird colonel over in Germany. He's about to retire here pretty soon, but he and I have remained close. And to say that, you know, my level of gratitude towards him is massive would still be an understatement, because as much as I believe anything is possible, if they had done what's known as a hip disarticulation, where they basically take your leg apart at the hip and just remove the whole thing, if they had gone that route, if they had played it safe, if he had listened to his staff, there's really no practical way I could continue to be doing what I'm doing now. So, you know, this guy took a huge risk, and because of that, he gave me my lifestyle back.
What are some of the things you and your father talked about while you were in the hospital for 6 months?
I was mostly business, man. Especially once I got done with my surgeries, The phased model when at Walter Reed, I get there, I'm first in the intensive care unit, which is like round the clock monitoring. You know, I'm get to the point where I'm somewhat stable, and then I move into inpatient, where you're living in a hospital room. And now I'm going through surgery 2 or 3, sometimes 4 times a week to try to cut this infection out. So they're just incrementally amputating my leg higher and higher and higher, cutting out more and more tissue and muscle, ramming me full of antibiotics. That process went on for about 6, 7, maybe 8 weeks until they got rid of the infection. Then I began just working with my prosthetist, learning how to live on an prosthetic, and then I moved into what they call outpatient, which you're basically living in a apartment on the Walter Reed compound. So what we would discuss, you know, intensive care, not much discussion. Like, I'm basically, machines are just hooked up to me around the clock. I'm completely incoherent, so not a whole lot of communication happening. Inpatient, it was mostly about looking forward to getting back up on two legs, you know, so, hey man, this is what this is going to look like. And then me, you know, tripling down on the things that I could do in those moments, which started off extraordinarily simple, where I would just like raise my left leg up and down like a million times a day. So I was so target fixated on recovery that was really all that we kind of discussed. And then he'll tell you, I'll close here, is once I got to outpatient and I'm working with my physical therapist, I'm in the gym, I'm on my leg, I'm like really getting after it. I was pretty much a maniac. So I really didn't want to entertain anything other than like the task at hand. So I would only want to talk about like what my next training session looked like, what my next meals looked like, when I needed to take my nap, when I needed to be in bed. And I just needed him to be that advocate and that kind of accountability guy to help me and keep me on track. So it was mostly business. And then, you know, we did eventually start talking about my goal being going back to a team. And he would tell you that he was on the surface extraordinarily supportive of that. Like, yeah, man, you got this. Absolutely. Like, let's get you back. Let's go. I know you can do it. That kind of thing. In the back of his mind, really two things were happening. One was fear of him maybe having to relive a scenario like this. And second, I don't think this is actually possible, but I want to be supportive now because he's really working hard and going after it. So he would tell you that even he, who knows me better than probably anyone on this planet, really didn't think that what I was trying to do was practical or possible. But he was still right there in my corner, man, the whole time.
You know, a few things, we've kind of done the story a little backwards. Maybe you could reveal to people your size. It's different than most normal human beings. You're not only just extremely tall, but a giant fucking human being too at that. So just to paint a picture, and the reason I asked that is, like, I'm curious as to, do you remember, the first thing I'm going to ask is the amount of pain that you lived with then, and is there continuing pain after all of this?
Yeah. So my size really worked against me in a lot of ways. You know, when I was wounded, so I'm somewhere around 6'5", somewhere between 6'5" and 6'6" in height. When I was wounded, I was sitting at around maybe 275, 280, which was a little bigger than I normally would sit, but it was just the time of year that we were over there. When the snow comes in January, everything pretty much stops because you're buried. Everyone's buried. Us, the enemy, locals, like no one can move. So for like 2 months, all we did was eat and like Jack Steel, like 3 days, like three times a day. That's all we did. So I was wounded in March, just after we came out of that winter season, just as the quote fighting season began again, was when I was wounded. So I was a little bigger than normal. I was around 280. Normally I would hang around, you know, 270. So obviously, you know, a big dude. But then in the hospital, I lost what ended up being, you know, like 70 pounds. So I ended up being down around like 205, 210, which like totally threw me off, like mentally. I was totally emaciated, you know, which is tough when your physicality is such a huge part of who you are as a human. Now I'm all shriveled. I'm weak. I lifting a 5-pound dumbbell was challenging. So like mentally, that was really difficult to deal with. And then obviously, you know, it starts to come back as you start to train. But, you know, my height and my size, coupled with the length of my residual limb, which is the polite way of saying stump. So my stump, right, my actual limb itself, my femur is only 4 inches long. So it's really, really short. And there's no muscle in it because the infection ate it all. So they cut out my quad, my hamstring. It's just this little bitty thing of bone and some soft tissue. So when you're 6'6", and you know, you're growing in size, so from 210 to 220 to 230, when I'm tall and big and I have a really small stump to work with, that means that my prosthetic has to be considerably longer So you're trying to manipulate a much longer lever with really little force to generate any kind of movement within that lever. So just from like a geometry and physics perspective, it's difficult because of my height and my size. But those were just, you know, additional challenges that I had to work through. It's not like I had anything to compare it to. It wasn't like, oh man, if I was only 5'5", this would be a lot easier. It's just like, this is how tall I am. This is how tall my prosthetic is. Like, let's go to work. And also with the size, it's kind of wild because, you know, I've lost about 45 pounds that would normally be on my body. So like, as I sit there talking to you right now, I'm probably, you know, like 220, maybe 225. But if I had my leg on me, like if I had my real leg still, you know, I'd be at like 265-ish, like give or take. So when people ask me like, hey, how much do you weigh? Because I get a lot of traffic about fitness and whatnot. How much do you weigh? I'm like 215, 220. They're like, what? That's impossible. I'm like, I'm looking at you. There's no way that you got to keep in mind, I'm missing 45, 50 pounds of leg. And then in terms of pain, the biggest thing for me is the phantom limb pain, which is a wild phenomenon. You know, it's the result of a loss of a limb, and it's a neurological syndrome where, you know, your brain is sending messages down to this extremity expecting to receive a return signal, which is what happens in our bodies all the time. When that just turns into a one-way street, the response is pain. Your body panics. It's like, whoa, like something's going on here. But it's crazy because I feel pain in my non-existent foot. So That can become just a trip in itself. And when I was in the hospital, it was really excruciating, and I was on medication for it to help calm it down. But the meds I was on, and I don't do well with meds. I don't do well with anything that kind of inhibits the way I think or act. So it gave me kind of this foggy feeling, and I didn't like it. So I basically just cut myself off cold turkey. The doctors were like, you cannot just stop taking this. I did it anyway. It was really horrible for a couple of weeks, but then I just kind of got used to it. So I still experience that now. Day to day, it's kind of just this tingly sensation that I feel in my non-existent foot. But as long as I'm up and I'm focused and I'm doing things, I don't really notice it. Sometimes at night when my brain is trying to shut off so I can sleep, it'll spike a little bit. So it does fuck with my sleep every now and then to a degree, but it's totally manageable. I don't take any medication for it. But and then other than that, man, there's no difference in my pain than it would for really anybody who lives, you know, an active lifestyle.
Were you ever sad about what happened or angry about what happened? And if the answer is yes or no, whatever it may be, when did you transition to accepting your injury?
I was really angry at first for a bit, but it was actually, I'd only been at Walter Reed for maybe a couple weeks, and some of my teammates reached out, and they just gotten back to the States from Afghanistan. So maybe it was a couple, 2-3 weeks, me being in the hospital. And a couple of my boys called me up. They eventually came to see me, of course, but they got them on the phone, and I was coherent enough to have a phone conversation. And they told me what had happened with the incident of me being shot up, right? So this is an insider attack. Again, this was an Afghan national police officer who opened fire on me and my team with a belt-fed machine gun from about 15 feet away. So 12 U.S. casualties total, 3 of which were killed. And then another 9 of us were wounded. Well, the information that these guys gave me was the backside of what had happened. And this was a widely successful tactic that the Taliban would use, where they would walk into someone's house, knowing that that person had access to us, and say, hey, here's the deal. You have two options. Option A is we brutalize your entire family right now, and then kill them and then kill you. We'll do that right now without any questions asked if you choose that option. Or option B is you go do this for us. You're dead either way. Either we kill you today or they'll kill you more than likely if you do this. However, if you take option B, we will take care of your family for the rest of their lives. They actually would follow through on that. So, you know, they used that tactic many times, and they built up a sense of credibility in actually doing so. So when that was made aware to me in that exact moment, any anger I had towards that individual was just gone, because a dude's put it between a rock and a hard place with no practical way to combat that. You know, like 12 guys show up to your house, you're a dirt farmer, and like they will do what they just said they did. So if I'm in that shoes, if I'm in that guy's shoes, I'm probably doing the same thing to protect my family. So that was a pretty big moment for me in terms of my like mental kind of transition, where the anger went away. I've never been the type to hold any kind of anger towards an adversary, towards an enemy. You know, like they're there doing what they believe they need to do, just the same as I am. It's like, this is the game we signed up to play. It's non-emotional for me, even in combat. It's not emotional. This is just business. Like, you're doing your job, I'm doing my job. Like, let's see who comes out on top today. So that moment for me was pretty revealing, and certainly sparked some growth. But I never really went down this negative road into the state of depression that a lot of guys struggle with. And I'm real sensitive when I throw this out there, Dennis, because it's not anything I'm proud of whatsoever, because it's also nothing to be ashamed of if that were to happen. You know, it's just, I was able to fixate my brain and my mind on my overall end state from the time I was in the intensive care unit. And I think that that is the thing that prevented me from going down this really negative, depressed state. Don't get me wrong, there were days of anger and frustration that happened at volume, but I was able to just stay focused on what I knew I needed to do. And that kind of kept me in a positive place most of the time.
Where does the positive mindset come from? Like, where does the resiliency, where does seeing it differently than most people see it, where does that come from in your life? When did you start taking positions like that? Because typically you would think guys in the military, special forces, clearly tough as fucking nails. But where does the positive mindset come from? Because you look at a guy like you say, man, I'm sure he's tough, right? He's clearly got that, but the mindset is interesting to me. Wow, you're so positive about all of this.
Yeah, man, this could be a real long conversation. I love having this one. I'll hit on two things quickly. One is, retrospectively, having done quite a bit of analysis and reflection on myself, I'd say my resilience or that toughness began for me as a kid. Growing up, you know, up in the Boston area, and, you know, me and my family, we moved every 12 months, moved around a whole bunch. You know, my parents struggling for work, struggling to maintain a home, and we moved every year. So I was the new kid in school every year, all the way up really until I got to college. So, you know, what today is looked at as bullying back then wasn't looked at the same. It was just kind of part of being a kid, you know, so I took, you know, a lot of beatings physically and way more emotionally, struggled socially. I became this real scared, small, insecure kid. And that was my character. That was part of who I was for a really long time. But what was happening concurrently, although I couldn't see it or appreciate it then, was I was building up this level of resilience. I was building up this toughness, this mental toughness, callousing my mind, and being able to gain more control over my emotions just through pure reps, because it's a skill. Resiliency and toughness is a skill. This is something that you need to learn how to do. And I started learning it at the time that I was, you know, 5 years old in kindergarten. And that went through all the way up until, you know, high school, college timeframe. So I look at that as a huge aspect of this. And then when you couple that with having an extraordinarily clearly defined and continuously refined goal, one that's positive, and it being something that is rooted in passion and purpose, two separate things that are oftentimes interwoven, but, you know, a true love of the game, of the achieving that, loving the game, it's like not the prize, but actually loving the process of getting to the point. And then purpose, meaning, like I mentioned, it was, I know that I was put on this planet to do this. So there's no alternative route for me. I don't know. I said this to you, maybe it was off air, but it's like, an apple tree produces apples. Like, that's what the tree's there to do. You may thank the tree for the apple, but the tree, if it could talk, would be like, yeah, of course. Like, I'm an apple tree. Like, I'm here to produce apples. I was put on this earth to be a warrior and to pledge an oath to a society. I know that without question. So I would look at maybe that tripod to answer that question. Resiliency built up through conditioning over time. And then a clearly defined goal that's rooted in both passion and purpose, I think is what I would answer to say that that is what enabled me to make it through a lot of really difficult times and challenges and tasks and setbacks and failures, and allowed me to keep going, really, no matter what happens.
Do you think that mental toughness and physical toughness kind of are maybe in the same category in some sense? If you do a little thought on that, one thing I think nobody can avoid is mental pain and anguish. So how do you think the two compare to each other? You think they're just as detrimental?
Yeah, this is a great conversation because, you know, like Western societies, we tend to separate these, just the way you stated it just now, into two separate things: physical pain, mental pain, physical well-being, emotional well-being. Well, you know, a lot of our like Eastern cultures that go back, they don't make that delineation. Like, they look at the body as one giant organism where discomfort's discomfort, growth is growth, and they're all interwoven. I would say that your mental wellness and your physical wellness are completely connected. It's like not many dots removed. And this is actually just like science, physiology, where, you know, continuous negative thoughts and negative emotions can actually make you physically sick. And the other way around, if you can flip that and you're producing positive hormones and positive effects emotionally, mentally, that can make you better physically. Do I think there's a difference? I do think there's a difference, right? There's a difference between, you know, if you walk up to a girl who you really like and you say, hey, can I take you to dinner? And she's like, get away from me. Like, that hurts. So does if I stick my hand in a fire, that also hurts. So two different types of pain, but really, I think we're just talking about discomfort overall. And the more comfortable we can get with discomfort, right? Becoming comfortable being uncomfortable, I'll stand by saying that it is essential to growth in general. And then to just summarize it, the size of the struggle or the size of the discomfort is commensurate with the size of the goal. So they're of equal value, meaning if you're trying to pursue something massive, the struggle is going to be equally large, where we would prefer it to be, I want to play in the NFL, but I want it to be really easy to do that. Like, that's not going to happen. If you want to play in the NFL, it's going to take a whole lot of discomfort and suffering that you have to put yourself through to achieve that. So I like that philosophy, because it's just a reminder that when I'm going through really difficult times and I'm experiencing pain and discomfort, whether it's physical because I'm in the gym and I'm pushing myself past failure on this particular set, or more on the emotional side or the mental side, when I'm feeling that discomfort, it's just a reminder that it is a necessary part of the journey, because it is an indicator that you are on a righteous path towards something worthwhile. Because minus discomfort, minus pain, what you achieve on the back end is commensurate with that. So as long as we have big goals, big dreams, and we're willing to pursue them, we have to anticipate the pain and discomfort coming down the road. And if it doesn't happen, I think it just means we've set the bar too low and we need to raise it up.
Yeah, I don't think anybody goes through life without experiencing discomfort, both physical and mental. And I remember telling my cousin one time, I said, you know, Dan, it's not that we can avoid life and the problems that it throws at us. It's just that we get better at navigating it. Because when you have charted these territories before, you know what they are, you're familiar. And some of the best things that ever happened to me were me hitting rock bottom many times in my life. And you would look at my life and say, well, rock bottom, you became a cop when you were 19. And that really has nothing to do with where I hit rock bottom a few times. I want to relate a little bit about my life to a similar resiliency. I had a very difficult childhood. And, you know, I often have made peace with that because I'm saying to myself, all right, well, listen, I'm the guy now running this police training company. And, you know, you said earlier, I know I was put on this planet to do this. That's a big, powerful statement because one, when you say it, it gives you purpose. But two, it gives people an opportunity to say, oh, you're fucking out of your mind. You're put on this planet to do this. Well, maybe that's the revelation some people who have found greatness, what they believe to actually achieve the greatness. But the emotional things that I had to go through as a child, and again, same thing if anybody goes through some of this stuff, really now I'm thankful for, because as the leader of an organization and somebody who has now become a mainstream target at times by the media, and I'm not trying to toot my own horn, or there's real shit that goes on. You know, I've been rocked to my core at times, and I just keep telling myself the same thing. Time comes and goes, folks. That's it. It's going to get better. It's going to get worse. It's going to get better. It's going to get worse. Give a little more time and just keep swimming. I don't mean to take up any time of that, but I just felt real connected to you about that because I can relate. And I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this as well. I think it's probably a good time now to at least, and I know you have a lot of conversation, a lot of story, and we are on limited time. You know, I want to make sure we make the best use of the time that we have together, but a lot of tours, a lot of combat. People really have to understand that, you know, I would suggest listening to your Jocko interview. It was 5 hours long. And so that's a real good place to really hear the most about Nick. But I think out of that, maybe talking about the incident that did take your leg. And because I think there's a complacency factor in there that maybe can relate to our law enforcement community that you spoke about. And then I want to go back to some of this other stuff, because I think you're going to really like where some of this shit goes today with you. But
yeah,
let's go into that incident that day and maybe some of the details of what occurred. And you know how to tell the story, so without further ado.
Yeah, man. I want to make sure I hit on a couple points because it's super important, especially for your audience, your community. So somewhat of kind of the fast version of the story is we're getting ready to go on a massive operation. We had our partner force that we lived with, an Afghan National Army Special Forces team. They were co-located. But then we also had Afghan National Police guys, Afghan National Army guys, Afghan local police, like a bunch of these different dudes. And although we had an SOP in place that prevented additional bodies from coming around us when we would do our mission brief, a truck pulled in. And I noticed it right away, which most of the guys did. Me as an 18 Bravo, being the weapons and tactics guys, we're also in charge of base defense. So this was a violation of our SOP, our standard operating procedure. So I see it, and you know, I'm at a crossroads where I need to decide if I'm going to deal with this now or if I'm going to wait and take kind of the more diplomatic route and bring this up to my leadership, and they'll bring it up to their leadership, you know, once we get done with work for that day. I ultimately ended up going with that route. You know, I said I'll bring this up to my captain, and he'll talk to, you know, to their commander. You could look at that as complacency, which is fair to look at it through that lens. It gets a little more complex when you also, you know, recognize or understand that as special forces guys, as the special forces detachment, as Green Berets, we make our money through indigenous personnel. You really don't send a group of Green Berets someplace to do stuff by themselves. We have other units that operate that way. You send a bunch of Green Berets someplace so you can take 12 dudes and put them anywhere in the world and create 250 man fighting force. Like, that's what we do. We're advisors, we're teachers, we're combat leaders. So everything that we do is done with indigenous personnel that sometimes we know pretty well and sometimes we don't know at all. So we assume this risk every time we go anywhere to do anything. So it's a delicate balance between security and rapport, right? Between security and relationships. We make our money through relationships. If that relationship completely implodes, we're out of business. We're out of work. So knowing that makes it less of an obvious decision to just, yeah, obviously you're going to walk right up to that guy and be like, what are you doing? Get out of here. Well, obviously I play this through my head just about every single day. What if, which is a dangerous game to play. I don't recommend doing that. But I know that we're put in those predicaments of that crossroads hundreds of times every single day that we're over there doing what we do. Dude comes in, Tom's checks are complete. I start walking towards my truck. rounds clock off behind me. I turn around. I see a guy. He had jumped up on the back of that truck, opened fire into the group about 20 feet away. One of our infantry soldiers, we had about 12 infantry guys that were there with us, mostly to help us with base defense. But every now and then we'd bring them out on operations with us. One of these infantry soldiers was set to come as one of our drivers that day. And I see him and he is frozen, like deer in headlights, staring at this guy shooting at him. So I know what my job is. My job is to move to a piece of cover, meaning move to something that can stop bullets and eliminate the threat. That's what I'm supposed to do in that situation. And I've rehearsed it, trained it, done it in real life a whole bunch of times. I know what the right answer is. But my love of a teammate supersedes me doing my job. And this isn't something that I'm proud of. This is actually a lesson learned about the importance of training and why we train a certain way. Like, standard operating procedures are built in low stress environments based off of years of data that's been collected through similar circumstances. Right? There's a reason why we react to near ambush the way we do. I don't do my job. And, you know, another game that I play is, well, like, why did I do that? Like, why didn't I do what I was supposed to do? The emotional side, right, wanting to protect someone I cared a lot about was certainly there. But for this conversation, it's important to note that prior to going to our mission brief, I had taken my rifle and I had put it in my truck, which was maybe 6 feet behind me. So my primary weapon system was in my truck. I had a pistol on my hip, but my rifle was somewhere else, which is another massive mistake. A very juvenile mistake. You know, like, you're like, that's like hammered into your head at basic training. So certainly some complacency on my personal behalf there, because I always wonder if my rifle was on me, even though I had seen this soldier in harm's way, would I have done what I'm supposed to do because of that muscle memory? You know, was there a second where I reached for my rifle and it wasn't there? So instead of doing what I needed to do, I just went towards this soldier instead. You know, there's no way to know this, but it's an important note within this kind of tactical audience. You know, one, the importance of the tools that we carry and why we carry them, and when we need them on our persons, and then the importance of training to reinforce SOPs, standard operating procedures. Right, those are the two massive takeaways from this. And to round out the story, instead of doing my job, I go for this soldier. I put my back towards the shooter, so I'm pretty much chest to chest with this infantry kid, and that's when I was hit for the first time, just in the upper portion of my right leg, and it knocked me down on top of this soldier. You know, that a PKM machine gun from 15 feet away, it hits you like a train is hitting you. It's a very powerful weapon system. I end up on top of this soldier. I feel another two or three impacts to my lower body. So I know I'm hit. I drag myself and this soldier, maybe like 6 feet behind a truck, reach over, I grab a rifle off the ground. I go to put it in action. I take some horribly placed shots at the shooter. I don't have any positive effects. One of my teammates comes in, smokes this dude. And this was the initiation of a complex ambush. So when this guy kicked off his gun, we started taking rockets and machine gun fire from outside of our perimeter. So it's an ongoing firefight. I can tell that we're in the middle of a fight, but I'm in no position to deal with any of the other threats. So I check the status of the soldier. He's fine. He's in shock, but no holes. He can breathe. So he's good. And then I check myself, rip my pant leg open. And my right leg is just absolutely mangled. It looked like it was put through a meat grinder, exposed bone tissue, just, yeah. You know, like as if a shark had just grabbed it and just like chewed on it a whole bunch. So I'm pissing blood out of my thigh. And I can see the river that's flowing from where I was to where I was initially hit. And I know my femoral artery has been cut, which it was. My femur was totally shattered. So I put a tourniquet on myself. I put a second tourniquet on myself. One of my teammates eventually gets to me and, you know, he looks at me and he's just like, the look on his face said what I knew to be true, which was I'm dying here right now. In fact, he put a third tourniquet on me and I was trying to get him away from me. I was trying to tell him to to go work on someone else that could be saved because I knew I was dying and I didn't want to wasting precious minutes or seconds. I didn't know how many of our guys were hurt, but I knew that there was a whole bunch of them. People are laying down on the ground all around me, screaming, crying. It's a total mass casualty scenario. He ignores me. He gets a third tourniquet on. He gets IV access for, you know, blood products or for meds or whatever would need to come on board. And then we said our goodbyes and he went on to work. He had a lot of work to do. So I'm laying there and, you know, I can still see blood seeping out of one of the wounds. So I know I'm still bleeding out. And I'm like, yeah, man, I might have another like minute or two left here before I'm totally drained. So I grab some gauze out of my kit and I just ball it up, loosen up one of the tourniquets, and I just ram this gauze up into my thigh, kind of reaching up towards my hip. And I'm trying to feel the pulse of the femoral artery, you know, and we do things like this in training. I've never obviously had done it on myself before, but when you're losing that much blood, your blood shunts inward towards your organs to keep you alive as long as possible. So I have no dexterity in my hands at all. It's just like totally numb. So I really can't feel anything. I'm brushing past shattered bone. Now the pain really kicks in for the first time and I'm on the verge of going unconscious. And I'm just like, come on, man, stay alive, stay focused. Come on, you got this. Like work, find it. You can do it. And I think I feel something. I really just got totally lucky. And I just ram down as hard as I can with this gauze. I feed the rest of the gauze on top of it. I lock in the tourniquet and then I go unconscious, you know? So I come to maybe a minute later, I drag myself over to some of my teammates who were wounded. And I know my time on earth is coming to an end. And I was surprisingly okay with that. Frustrated that it was going to be at the hands of someone who I taught how to use the gun he shot me with. So I was irritated about that. I felt some guilt about what my family would have to deal with and experience. But, you know, as someone who accepted the mentality of, you know, come back with your shield or on it, that's more than just a cliche sentence for a lot of us. If I was dying, it was going to be alongside my boys in combat. So I was surprisingly okay with that end state. Decided I was going to spend my last minutes on earth just kind of trying to comfort my teammates who were dealing with some pain. And about 90 minutes later, I was loaded on to a medevac bird. I took that amount of time for them to be able to come in because of the ongoing fight that we were dealing with. Got sent to a more austere location for medical treatment, needed a blood transfusion really bad. And I was given one with an incompatible blood type. And here's where people start to lose their minds when they hear this story for the first time. Like, how the fuck does that happen? Holy shit. Well, what happened, to give your viewers the answer to that question? There was me and two of my teammates were on the same helicopter, one of which has a very similar last name to mine. The last names both begin with L and A, and we both needed blood. Well, they switched up the bags. So they gave me his blood type. They gave him my blood type. Well, I'm O positive, which means I'm a universal donor. I can give blood to anybody. He is AB negative, which is extremely specific blood type. So it essentially killed me. Everything began shutting down, my liver, my lungs, kidneys, everything. They didn't know what was wrong. They just knew I needed to get to Bagram, which is where our closest hospital was. So they put me on a helicopter, sent me to Bagram, and I was maybe in the air 3-4 minutes. It's like a 9-minute flight. And they realized that they're giving my teammate my blood type. And that's what triggered them to go, oh shit, what did we just give Nick? They saw what happened. They call Bagram and they say, hey, we just pumped Nick full of an incompatible blood type. There's no way he survives this flight. Just be prepared to receive his body when he gets there. And in a lot of ways, they were right. You know, I coded. They had the panels going. They were hitting me with shots of adrenaline, you know, basically just last ditch effort kind of shit to keep me somewhat alive. Pulled me off the bird, took my foot off, put me on dialysis, blood transfusion, intubated, machines were just keeping me alive completely at that point. And you know, it was real, I say touch and go for 48 hours, but I was essentially, you know, dead or on life support. And then I came back And obviously I survived, man, because I'm here talking to you.
We interview a lot of police officers who were shot, sometimes significantly injured in the line of duty. And actually, same thing happens, right? They're coding. And often they will tell a story about experiencing something beyond this earth. Do you have any experiences like that at all?
I just had this conversation the other day. I didn't see a light. I didn't hear any music. My thoughts were, like I said, with most of my parents and my now wife, who at the time we were just kind of starting to become a thing. But no NDE, which I just learned, this is like an acronym for near death experience and like what happens to some people. Interesting knowledge I learned there through someone who went through some pretty nasty stuff and did experience some things like that. I didn't. I'm not sure if that's a good sign. Maybe it's something I should be concerned about. But no, man, I got nothing for you.
Tell us about the men whose lives were lost in that day, and what did that mean to you? What did they mean to you? I think it's worth a mention, right, dude? You know what I mean? Like, I think that we can spend all this time talking about us, but I think it certainly deserves at least a few minutes to discuss who those people were and what Absolutely. They went through.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. First was Captain Andrew Peterson Keel, who was our detachment commander. So our captain, he was a replacement because our first team leader, during the incident where I was shot in the face, our original team leader that we deployed with was severely wounded during that engagement. So PK is what we call them. Captain Peterson Keel, he came in as a replacement to our original detachment commander. And that is really difficult to do, regardless of what your position you're in. But when you're the detachment commander, when you are the guy in charge, and you show up to a team who at this point is battle-hardened, and we have been through dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of engagements as a unit prior. Our captain was just severely wounded. And about a week later, maybe less, this dude shows up who none of us have ever met before. That is almost an impossible scenario to come into. Well, PK, originally from Connecticut, did it with absolute professionalism and just an amazing leader and human being to be able to adapt to that environment that fast. Earn the respect and trust of a bunch of guys who have been through some really difficult stuff for 3 months every day. As fast as he was able to do that is uncommon. It's wildly uncommon. Next dude was Staff Sergeant Rex Shad. So I mentioned that we had an infantry squad that was over there. Rex was their squad leader. He was a staff sergeant, but he was leading a bunch of privates. Aside from him, I think every single other one of those guys, it was their first deployment ever. Most of them were fresh out of basic training. So Rex is put in an extraordinarily difficult position where he's leading a bunch of 18, 19-year-old children who have never really done anything before in life, right? Like graduated high school, went to basic training, went to their unit, and now they're off in Afghanistan. Not only is he leading that element, but he has to work homogeneously alongside a special forces detachment, which is nerve-wracking and difficult to do. It's like these guys look up to us, you know, they're like, wow, these guys are like the baddest dudes on the planet. A lot of them want to be Green Berets. It's intimidating for anybody. I don't care who you are and how tough you think you are. Like, that's in a really difficult, intimidating environment to have 11 or 12 kids and have to work alongside and with a group of Green Berets. Rex was able to do it to the point where even just within a few weeks, we had enough trust within him as a leader, an individual, and the unit that he led and those individuals, and started bringing them out on ops. We started letting them run guns for us. We started letting them drive trucks for us. We started bringing them on target with us, dismounted. So that doesn't happen without Rex Shad's leadership. And then lastly was Bach. And Bach was our military working dog, which there is no difference in most of our opinions between our dogs and our Cubans. And I'm in the same boat. Like, we lost three service members that day because Bach very much was a service member. And Bach was wounded twice prior on the same deployment. So I earned 3 Purple Hearts on that trip. Bach was earned 3, I think they call it Purple Paws. So he was wounded twice in combat prior to being killed on March 11th, 2013. So you would talk about an absolute savage. This dog was just as much of a teammate to me as anyone else that was there. He had found dozens of IEDs that if he hadn't, one of us would have been wounded or killed for months leading up to that point. So these three warriors, man, they paid the ultimate sacrifice. And I'm just grateful that I had the opportunity to spend the time that I got to with them.
Have you ever reached out to their families and told them how you felt about them?
Yeah. So I talked to PK's mother on a regular basis. Actually, she wrote an excerpt in my book that began with me reaching out to her and saying, hey, I'm going to put a picture of Andrew in my book, and I want to put some stuff in there about, you know, what we experienced together. First, I need your blessing on that. But also, I extended it to her. I got these third party perspective portions of the book that some of my teammates and colleagues wrote. And I asked her if she wanted to write something for the book. And she said she very much did. So her name is Helen, and her and I stay in touch pretty consistently, as well as Rex's mother and brother and sister. We stay in pretty frequent comms, as well as Bach's handler as well. So yeah, man, I imagine that those relationships will maintain until I am no longer on this earth.
Probably means a lot to them. Even if it's hard for you to do, it's probably means a lot to them to hear that.
And, you know, I will say that the soldier that I got in front of, that I ended up on top of, his mother hits me up every year on the anniversary of the incident. And I know it's difficult for them, so I just kind of let them manage that whenever they feel appropriate, because I think they feel, you know, a little bit of guilt, you know, survivor's guilt. It's a real thing. I stay in touch with them as well. So it's pretty powerful to maintain those comms. And I just think it's important for us to do that.
And I also want to acknowledge the other servicemen who were also affected by this and injured as well. I mean, we don't have to go into the remaining injuries, but certainly deserves time for recognition of what they went through as well. And don't want to downplay that one bit, because they didn't lose their lives. They certainly sacrificed quite a bit, I imagine.
Absolutely.
So you come back, tell me about your relationship with your now current wife. How did that progress once you were back?
She was in Afghanistan. She's also active duty Army. She was in Afghanistan on the same deployment as me. She obviously wasn't working where I was, but she was working out of Bagram. So she had a front row seat to me getting pulled off the helicopter, essentially dead, and then, you know, brought back to life, and was by my side during the 5-6 days that I was in Afghanistan for them to get me stable enough to survive a flight to Germany. And then she still had another month or so left in country. So I was at Walter Reed, and she's in Afghanistan, and I'm going through surgeries, and I'm pretty whacked out on all the pain meds and anesthesia. But her and I had developed, you know, a pretty strong bond during that deployment. We weren't in the same place, but just phone calls, emails. She was actually a detachment leader for one of the guys that was attached to my team. So there was some professional connectivity that we had. And she just became, you know, an asset for me to, you know, to vent to and to talk to after some really difficult days that we had out there, and that those just continued on. So we began forming a more, a different relationship than we had. Her and I had known each other for like 10 years prior. And then I'm at the hospital, and, you know, she gets home and she comes to visit me. And once I get mobile enough, I could go down to North Carolina to the Fort Bragg area to visit her. And, you know, this was like our courting phase, right? I mean, like, we really didn't date, but this was during the time that in normal relationships, you're putting your best foot forward. You're doing all the fancy dinners and you're doing all the things, right? For us, this was, you know, I'm at my weakest, like lowest point that I've ever been in, ever. Like, she's seen the real rawness from the very beginning, which I look back on now, just extraordinarily grateful, because when you're doing the normal thing and you're putting your best foot forward, it's only a matter of time before the real you comes out, right? And then for a lot of relationships, like, that doesn't work at that point. It's like, oh man, like, you're not the facade that you had been playing for like 3 months, 4 months, 5 years, whatever. Her and I never even had the chance to do that, because I was living in this just very vulnerable, raw, low point, which I think is a huge part of why our relationship is so strong and successful now. And then, you know, once I left the hospital, I moved in with her, which was kind of a risk, but I really didn't have anywhere else to go. So it made sense. And I was there maybe 2 weeks, Dennis. I was there maybe 2 weeks. And again, I'm target fixated. I'm obsessed. I'm out of my mind. All I'm doing, back the team. And, you know, when you're at Walter Reed, it's a lot easier to live in that mentality because you're in this bubble. Like, there's nothing else to do. You're literally living at the hospital. There's no distractions. There's no other options to do things or to spend time with other people. It's just you, your physical therapist, your occupational therapist, your doctors, that's it. When you get home, all the distractions and other aspects and other opportunities of everyday life shows up. And it's like, I know I need to maintain this highly rigid, super structured, focused lifestyle if I'm going to have a shot at doing this thing. It's just going to be a lot more difficult now. So I sit her down. I'm home maybe 2 weeks. I'm living in her house. And I'm like, hey, babe, I have to do this. I have to pursue this. I don't have another option. And in order for me to do it and even have a shot at it, I have to completely commit to this. And what that means for us is that there will be no dinners. There will be no going to weddings. If someone dies, I'm not going to the funeral. Like, this is my lifestyle. Here it is on paper. I wake up at 3:30. I go to bed at 9:30. This is what I do in between, minute by minute by minute. I will live this as close to as possible by the minute every single day until one of two things happens. I make it back to my team or I die trying. That's it. And I understand if you don't want to be a part of this, because what I'm saying probably sounds a little bit insane. And she was on board with it, man. And, you know, not only was she supportive, she became my number one teammate. She was an asset. And, you know, I look back to today, every time I bring this up, I get emotional because, you know, my family is the best part of my life, the best part of my world. And we have an amazing life with two amazing, you know, small boys. And if she had taken the path of least resistance, if she had taken the route of normal, she would have been like, yeah, dude, what you're describing is insane. I don't really know you all that well. So I'm going to go with no, which would have been understandable. And then also everything we have here right now just wouldn't have existed. And that just would have been an absolute, you know, tragedy. So to say I'm grateful to her for both what she did for me at that time, as well as what she has given us, the lifestyle we have now, is really because she had the strength to stay the course and stay along by my side during this process. So pretty amazing person. I'm one of those that married up, which I strongly recommend.
And I think sometimes for us, it's you don't know amazing until you actually meet amazing. And when you get those amazing people in your life, oof, don't let them go.
You know, man.
What's the best thing about being a dad?
I'll tell you, it's the hardest job I've ever had. And although I was the one of the ones that, you know, read a bunch of the books, the articles to prepare myself, you just kind of have to figure it out. Mm-hmm. In real time. And it's the hardest job, but it's also the most rewarding job I've ever had. And just to have the opportunity to guide, mentor, teach this little, you know, miniature version of yourself, and then watch that be molded and take shape. And when he adds his own, you know, flair to it, even at the age of five, you start to see like this human that's learning, but then is also imposing his own will on things. I'm like, dude, that's not how I taught you how to do that, but that was awesome. Like you're being you. So I think the process of teaching is certainly there, but someone to hold me accountable as a man, hold me accountable to my own values and my own beliefs and my character, because there is no room for wiggle on that when these young people are sponges and they're just absorbing everything that you say and do. And believe me, I make plenty of mistakes along that route. And then lastly, I'll just say, you know, they're deeply rooted in my why. And, you know, it's something I know a lot of people struggle with is like, what is my why? Like, what is your why? Why are you here? What's the point? What are you trying to do? Who are you trying to become? At this point, it's a really easy connection between everything I do day to day, you know, micro to macro, to those three human beings, my wife and my two boys. So I can't imagine now living life without kids, which is wild to say out loud, because I was that guy, Dennis, that all I wanted to do was, you know, be an operator and kick ass and take names, and that was it. This was me. I met the right person, wanted a family bad, was blessed with two. And now I look back at, I'm like, I can't even fathom living any other way, man. It's truly a blessing.
I said to somebody recently, I said, you know how I know I'm a great dad? And they said, how? I go, because every day I go home and try to be a great dad. That's it.
That's it.
It's constant effort of trying to be a great dad. I played with my daughter last night. I was exhausted. I've had a tough day. At 9:15, and she brought like four Barbies over. She's the youngest one. She's three this month, or next month she'll be three. You know, it's interesting to watch this, me stepping out of it for a second, looking at this person who I am, and literally sitting there and having joy that I can't quantify, and holding a purple haired Barbie, doing a British accent and playing with her on the couch.
Yes.
Or like how impressed my sons are with my Fortnite abilities. And, you know, what I wanted to say on my gravestone, no matter what I do with this world, how people think I'm changing it, what I think I'm doing for law enforcement and for the world in general, I just wanted to say he was the best dad. That's all I wanted to say. I have one last question before we leave. And I've asked this quite often a lot, because I have heard you speak about your difficulty with school and you weren't a scholar and all that shit. Same thing for me. And same thing for our guests yesterday and a lot of previous guests as well who are doing great things. The world sometimes tell you, or will tell you, that you are not smart or not valuable. But when did you find out you were not only smart, valuable, but also highly intelligent? Because you're a very intelligent man.
If I have to put a moment in time, I will use my first deployment as an amputee. And here's why. In the hospital, fortunately, I was able to accept this relatively quickly. It was really difficult, but I got past it pretty fast, that no matter what kind of prosthetic they give me, no matter how many hours I spend in the gym, I'm never going to be as physically dominant as I was with two legs. It's not going to happen. So how can I make up the ground that I'm going to lose physically in order to still be the same asset? So I'm losing some physicality. How can I bring that up? And it was in the realm of, you know, my intelligence and my cerebral capacity, my cognitive abilities. I knew that there was a lot more work I could be doing there, because I didn't do a lot of work in those arenas. You know, when I got to the team as a 6'6", 270-pound college football athlete, MMA fighter, like, I brought physicalness to the team, and that's what they asked of me, and that's what I liked to do. So it was a win-win for everybody. I spent my time in the weight room, in the fight house, on the track. If I was reading something, it was exercise physiology or nutrition, or that was what I enjoyed. That's what the team asked of me. Perfect. Well, you lose your leg, you want to go back to a detachment. How do you do that? So I forced myself into these areas of what really are requirements for a special forces team to be successful. And these are kind of the softer skills of our business. You know, most want to think about, or do think about, kicking down doors, shooting bad guys in the face, like jumping out of planes, all the high speed cool guy stuff, which is fine. And we do that, and most of us love it. But there's a whole bunch of other things that are necessary for any for us to create the effects we need to create operationally. So I kind of just parsed that out and, you know, put together a program and a strategy around these tasks and skills. And I just forced myself to do it. And although I really didn't enjoy it, I believed that it would increase my value that I would lose physically in order to maintain myself as an asset to my teammates. And I did that. And, you know, so rather than reading about nutrition, I was reading about cultural dynamics in the Middle East, right? Rather than studying a different way to organize my physical training programming, I was enhancing my foreign language capabilities. So I just sacrificed some stuff in the physical realm. Obviously, I'm still in the gym and I'm getting after it, but I'm also investing a lot of time and energy in these other things. And the reason why I put my finger on my Afghanistan trip in 2015, my first as an amputee, was I was able to actually employ a lot of these different things that I had just forced myself to learn on my own. And the feedback from my teammates and my leadership because of that are like, hey, if you weren't here to do this, we wouldn't have been able to do what we just did. Like, you made that happen and you did it on your own. You weren't forced to go to that school, or you weren't forced to learn about this thing or whatever. You just did it. And we were able to get something out of it. Like, you increased our operational success over here. So it really invalidated a lot of the work that I had done. It validated the discipline that I forced myself to instill on to myself to be able to do it. And it was, I guess, in that moment or a series of those moments, looking back, going, wow, you know what? I'm not the knuckle dragging jock grunt meathead that I kind of always identified myself as. You know, as a young person, I wanted to be the jock at the cool kids table because that's what the popular kids were. Like, you know, I grew up an athlete, and now I'll really put myself on the couch. I grew up an athlete, but I often wonder, was I really that in love with playing sports, or did I just want to be respected and I wanted to have friends? Cause again, I struggled with that. Did I really love football as much as I convinced myself I did? Or was that just my outlet to being someone that I could respect and someone who other people would respect, you know? So I really wanted to be this physically dominant, almost knuckle dragging caveman, moron, badass type. Like, that's who I really wanted to be. And then once I had my mind set on learning something that I knew I really needed to learn so that I could go do something that I loved, having done that and then retrospectively looking back going, wow, you know what? I'm not as much of a meathead as I kind of thought I was, or I kind of convinced myself I was. So I guess maybe to answer the question is a different way, I would say that would be a moment, not necessarily the moment, but certainly an awakening moment where, like, holy shit, I actually am much more of an intellectual than I thought. But what's key for that for me is that I genuinely, you know, love this stuff. So, and a lot of people struggle in school, and it's like, cause they're being forced to, like, study and memorize and learn things. But once you find yourself in a position where you're learning and you're expanding your mind around things that you enjoy, I think that same revelation can happen for, you know, anybody.
There's a saying, and I'll wrap with this. It's life happens to us, not for us. Boy, I don't know if anybody's embodied that more than you have. And to see you make the turnaround and come back with such a positive attitude and resiliency, and the way you see life and the appreciation you have for everything and the way you respect the world, it's clear as day to me that you were a chosen one. And these things happened for you, you know, and it had to be you. That's what the world needed, was you. I'm sure you know that already, but just want to remind you and let everybody know that this is how you know when somebody is the person. So,
I appreciate that, Dennis.
Yeah, of course, man. So listen, I appreciate the time we spent today together. I know we're a little bit past where we wanted to end. It means a lot to a lot of people. We have a lot of listeners, and they will certainly undoubtedly reach out to me and say that one was really, really, really good. And I found a lot of value in it. So I don't want you to think any of the time today was not going to be valuable to a lot of people, because it is. And that just goes to prove more why you were the chosen one, because you were selfless enough to say, you know what, I can spare 90 to 100 minutes today to share what it is that I've been through. And a lot of people will tell me I was shot. And I remember that I've heard that guy's voice. I know what he went through and what he's saying to himself. And I heard him. It meant a lot to me. I was in the hospital. I was injured. I remember hearing, Nick talk about that on the podcast, and it really gave me hope and strength. And I just was going through similar circumstances, and although different, very similar circumstances for law enforcement and the military and the circumstances of what this job could bring to you. So on behalf of the law enforcement community, boy, we owe you one.
No, man, sure. I want to wrap with this, man, as the level of respect I have for you personally and your entire organization you represent, it's tough to quantify. It's a wild world, man. We go down a tangent. I won't do it. You know, I'm thankful for what I do every day. It's great. And I'm humbled every time. I don't know how you guys do what you do in today's world. I got a lot of friends and family that are in law enforcement up in Massachusetts mostly. And I'm just like, dude, I don't know how you do this, man. The level of scrutiny that's on, you guys and gals, these service members, that you do this, public servants, it's like one wrong word, and or even not that, or just the perception of a wrong word. It's just under a microscope. And still you go out every day selflessly and thanklessly, for the most part, and you maintain our society. It's like the level of discrepancy between gratitude towards military personnel and law enforcement personnel, I think, is just absolutely ridiculous. So for whatever it's worth, coming from me, I could not do what you do. I know that about myself. Someone has to do it. It's an enormous, enormous aspect of a functioning society, because without that, things look very different. I've been to places that looks like, and believe me, no one here is even remotely prepared to live in that world. So I'll say it for those that don't have that level of perspective, what you guys do is a critical component to how we live and the way we live. So just a wholehearted thank you for what you do. Coming on this, talking to you for just like a couple hours is a privilege of mine, man. So I appreciate it. I look forward to doing it again, man. Thanks.
Awesome, brother. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.